We got a large poster of Steve McQueen at the end of the bed stuck up. I'll tell you what, we got a DVD of Steve McQueen for her. And this individual was entirely happy to spend, to watch the film almost on a loop, you know, on her television. Well, she knew it word perfectly almost, yeah, you know, whatever. But she loved it.
Mm.
And she was, you could see it in her face, yeah, you know, without question. So fine. That's what they like.
That was Julia Hamer Hunt from Oxfordshire Advocacy, who was giving an example of the difference it makes to a person with dementia when we know something about them. This podcast is about memory recording. Older people's photos, stories, letters, and other personal effects have long been used to put together memory boxes and books so that staff in homes can get a better sense of the people they care for. But it's arguably difficult for memory recording schemes to get any priority when there are high-profile scandals such as Winterbourne and the failings highlighted in the Care Quality Commission report. How can memory recording find a place when there is a struggle going on with the basics? Is it a luxury that can be dispensed with in favour of other priorities when there are funding cuts? I hope this podcast can help to change these questions to ones about how memory recording work could further enhance life for people with dementia. In this podcast, we'll be looking at what memory recording is about, how it's beneficial, what the obstacles are, how advocates can help, and how new technologies can expand on what can be recorded. We'll hear from Julia again, along with other people working in care services, the arts, and even cutting-edge technology. But before that, an introduction. My name is Jeff Lee, and this podcast is intended to increase public awareness of memory recording work for people with dementia. There will also be recommendations for advocacy groups that are thinking of using memory work to help people with dementia, and some of the content will also be of interest to people affected by other conditions, such as strokes and brain injuries. In addition to this podcast, I'm writing a quick start guide for advocacy groups so that they won't have to duplicate the legwork I've put in to find out the things that are relevant to them. My project is for the Older People's Advocacy Alliance, or OPAL for short, a charity that brings UK advocacy groups together so that there is a more unified approach to policy and practice. I managed to get funding to work part-time on this for 4 months, so it's not a full-scale research project, but rather an opportunity to generate the kinds of discussions that are necessary to make new memory recording services a reality. Before we hear some of the people I've spoken with, a few notes about terminology. When I say advocacy, I'm not referring to legal representatives in a court, but lay advocates, people whose role is to speak on behalf of other people who, for whatever reasons, are unable to speak for themselves. When the people they're speaking for have a dementia, the reasons are fairly obvious. Their ability to understand, think, or speak may be severely affected. And what is meant by memory recording is a way to record things about a person with dementia that may help to keep them in touch with the person they are and help their family and carers stay connected with them also. A major example of a memory recording project is Your Story Matters, a Department of Health-funded project that trained 500 people who work with the life stories of people with dementia. A central figure in this is Jan Kendall of the Dementia Advocacy Network. She explains her involvement.
Your Story Matters was a project I got involved with, which was working with other people to create memory books for people with dementia. Now, we can do this chronologically from sort of birth up to now, but it depends upon the level of dementia and how advanced it is with people or how they want to talk. So sometimes it's just having conversations about their life, bits and pieces of their memories. It could be about their family and friends, special events, their work life, their interests, hobbies, achievements, anything that encourages them to have a conversation about their life. And we call them golden nuggets. Sometimes it's just little bits and pieces of their life that we then write down. And then we're going to put them in books, a bit like a photo album. So you've got a photo or a picture, a little caption to go with it. Then in the future, they will have this solid book that they can refer back to, and that can initiate conversation. So family and friends can use it with them, care workers can use it with them. And again, it's just a way of reflecting back on their life that will help them to have conversations with people, which can become more and more difficult as the dementia advances. So it's good to have that record there. And this is a written record, but there's no reason why that couldn't be done by audio or video or any other method or means you can think of. And that's what the Life Story Network is about, sharing all those different ways of doing it.
Schemes like Your Story Matters can record people's values, beliefs and other things that help to preserve who they are and what's important to them, so that decisions about them remain in line with their wishes when their capacity to decide fluctuates. But as intuitive and as good as this sounds, memory recording schemes are, as I suggested in my introduction, prone to being deprioritised during a recession. Anyone planning a scheme needs to clearly explain its advantages. These are recorded in the research literature and include understanding behaviour, enabling interactions, maintaining identity, and enjoyment of the recording process itself. But nothing gets it across better than examples. I told Jan about an example of where someone's care had been transformed by what was known about them, an example among many I've come across, much like the Steve McQueen story you heard at the beginning.
There are lots of stories as we learn more and more about dementia and how it affects someone. Lots of stories about the importance of knowing people's life history. The particular story that I often tell is the man who was in a care home, and every morning he got up and he covered all the furniture with anything he could find, like a sheet, a towel, a pillowcase. So all the furniture was covered. And every morning the care workers went in, oh, not again. So they got to put everything away and tidy it all up. And they just thought this was very bizarre behaviour because they didn't understand what he was trying to do and what he was trying to say through what he was doing. And basically the story unpacks that this man had been a decorator. And this was his routine every day, to get up and cover the furniture so he could do painting. So when they understood that and his need to be occupied, they began to look for things that he could do. So basically they found things that he could actually really paint to start with. And when they ran out of things he could paint with, he was then given just water and a paintbrush, and he could be quite happily painting. It was about being occupied. And that's what he was doing, that although he had dementia and it was quite advanced, he still had this need to be someone, to be recognised and to be occupied.
This engagement with people with dementia is a theme that arises time and time again as I speak with people about memory recording. And yet, a 2006 survey of research on life story work, authored by Jane McKeown among others, cites what is anecdotally known, that books and memory boxes can end up being unused. In care home settings, taking an interest is key to good care, let alone any kind of memory work. Louise Hughes of Age Cymru gave me an example.
Through these memory boxes, and you know, if you've got carers who take the time to look at somebody's life and get to know somebody and encourage people to start talking, it can make their quality of life so much better. You know, I've seen people sitting in chairs with nobody speaking to them for hours and hours on end. And I had a client who had dementia, who I used to go and talk to, and he was treated appallingly by some of the staff. And he'd sit there, and I'd sit there for an hour and very often talk about not a lot that was very important, but he was having a conversation. And he was feeling like he was being treated like a human being. And afterwards, I attended a care plan review. And the care home and the social worker were quite aggressive towards me because they said, well, since you've been, his behaviour's got much worse. And I said, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, after you've got, I said, when's his behaviour got worse? I said, after you've gone. Well, has anybody actually bothered to sit and talk to him? Because he'd realised, having somebody to talk to him, having somebody to spend some time getting to know him, he was a joy to talk to for me. I didn't have any problems with him. But because after I'd gone, nobody talked to him, that wasn't, you know, they hadn't even considered that. His behaviour getting worse because he was frustrated by nobody talking to him.
For Louise, memory recording means preserving something more important than individuals' memories alone. There are aspirations at stake about how we'd like to live in our later years.
I was involved a while ago with a project that was in Powys. There were issues for people who were in care homes and in daycare centres where they just kind of accepted their lot and they just accepted what was happening to them, and very often their rights weren't being upheld. So we looked at how we could use a sort of a reflective practice, because it was about what when you were younger, what did you expect? What were the sort of, you know, standards that you would expect for your care, and what would you expect? How would you have expected to be treated? You know, you wouldn't expect them to suddenly think, well, when I'm 60, 70, 80, however old you are, that you just put up with everything. But because of your powerlessness very often, because you're in services or that you are vulnerable because of situations, and we can all feel vulnerable and in awe of professionals, if you like, and not wanting to challenge, those people could have been very strong and independent people. But as they've got older, they're vulnerable, they may be abused, they may feel powerless, they may have nobody else to support them. And actually that you know, memory book can be really powerful for them and for their advocates to challenge, and helping them to remember how they wanted their lives to be.
We'll return to more about the benefits of memory recording later, when we look at what could be recorded and how technology could offer new ways of doing this. It's important in the meantime to raise something that seriously affects any recording, and that is the need to record memories early, so that they are less hampered by memory loss as a dementia advances. One of the problems for advocates doing any memory recording work is that they tend to get referrals at a late stage in someone's dementia. Referrals are usually made to advocates when something has gone wrong for the person with dementia, and this usually happens because the dementia has progressed. Late referrals is a huge topic, and delays can occur for a variety of reasons. A 2008 study by Karen Hirschman and others looked at the factors that affect advanced planning of healthcare, finances, and so on. Over 60% of families in the study said that by the time they wanted to discuss advanced planning, it was too late for their relative to be involved. Families can be overwhelmed by the news of a dementia, and the responses that were cited included avoidance of discussion and even denial of the diagnosis. One of the more hopeful findings was that a third of family members were prompted into discussions about planning because of conversations with healthcare professionals. The need for families to get these discussions going so that they can take early action is something recognised by the Department of Health. Julia Hamer-Hunt, who we heard at the beginning of this podcast, describes a pilot scheme in GP surgeries in Oxfordshire.
Oxfordshire still is, it's coming towards the end of the 3 years, was part of the pilot project funded by the Department of Health for having dementia advisors in GP's office, for trying to get people who were diagnosed with dementia or raise awareness for them in the GP's office, and also to raise awareness of GPs of, you know, of dementia and what was available out there.
Where was this planned for? Was that Oxfordshire alone, or was this
the pilot one? That was part of the national five-year national dementia strategy, and Oxfordshire was one of the pilot areas.
So have you not heard anything in terms of what's become of that, or is it too recent?
No, it's still ongoing. We've got dementia advisors in place here in Oxfordshire, and they work out of, and the scheme was actually extended earlier last year. It started off with three dementia advisors, and there's now, I think, five of them working, and they now work or hold surgeries across most of the GP's practices in Oxfordshire now.
This scheme means that dementia advisors are available to signpost families who have just received a diagnosis. However, as Julia pointed out, the scheme in Oxfordshire has a shortfall in people coming back to the advisors. The question for advocacy organisations in respect of memory recording is where to position advocacy services, given the difficulty in addressing the lack of early action that is one of the factors behind late referrals. I spoke with Claire Bain of Advocacy Plus in London. I put it to her that if advocates are usually called on when a dementia has progressed, then maybe other types of services are better placed for any earlier involvement in memory recording.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't see why not. And if other services are using it as well, I can only see that as being a good thing. Mm-hmm. Because it's basically about the person. And if people are, and to me, that is what advocacy is speaking up for people and helping them to express their wishes. So if other agencies are accessing you know, memories and things that will help to show what they want, then yeah, I think that's a great thing.
Claire's point has been something of a touchstone for me on this project. It's important to think about the person the memory recording is for when thinking about the boundary disputes that advocacy might find itself in with other services. Advocacy holds person-centred practice close to its heart, so it needs to find the right way to embrace the contributions that other services can make to memory recording. This doesn't mean that advocacy is badly placed for memory recording because of late referrals. What it can offer is close working relationships with clients and a high level of independence. This builds an unusually high level of trust with people with dementia. The advocate is so often a repeated presence that healthcare and social services professionals are not. This is especially the case in settings where there is a high turnover of staff, and dementia cases typically continue for very long periods. Mike Pochin of Dorset Advocacy thinks that advocacy lends itself to ensuring the continuity of memory recording.
I think what one could say is that, you know, there is merit in advocates undertaking memory recording in its own right because we're independent, because we're used to the person-centred approach and so forth. But I think I wouldn't want to lose an ongoing role in some situations for advocates to make sure that what is recorded remains alive. If you've got a person-centred planning document that was written, let's say, 5 years ago, how live is that as a document? You know, it'll give you a certain amount, won't it? But, you know, is there something about actually an advocate, or failing that, an advocacy organisation retaining some contact with the person to make sure that, as far as possible, that document is live and is seen to? Because, again, you say other agencies will pick it up. Well, not if it doesn't suit their budget, they won't.
This continuity is expanded on by Jan Kendall.
Anyone can do life story work, and family and friends can do it. And it is being much more encouraged now. Even care homes, they are being encouraged to do it. But it takes time to do it properly. Now, for advocates, we are very often called in towards the later stages. And what's important for advocates to know is about how important it is to have these things. And when you don't have them, it makes it very difficult for the advocate. There are advocates who can do this work because they may be a citizen advocate and they are in there long term with the people. So whereas a lot of other advocates come in, go out just as issues arise. But an important stage that advocates come in for is at the later stages, when we're talking about the person's quality of life. So the more you know about someone's life story, the more you can represent them and speak up for them and say, well, look, this is what their life story says. But also, even if dementia has deteriorated or communication's deteriorated, it's amazing what people can tell you that they might never have told someone else. So advocates can even add to people's life stories that are already there.
I said earlier that we'd return to the benefits of memory recording, which we now have, and I'd like to expand on them. One of the things that became apparent as I researched memory recording was how there is usually a certain amount of division between different practices. There's the life story work you've just heard so much about, and then there's work on exercising memory with puzzles and games. And there's reminiscence work, where people with dementia might, for example, get to hear some music from their days of youth. This separation seems curious. On the one hand, funding budgets can't cover everything, so definitions help to set out what funding is for. On the other hand, most of the aforementioned activities are information-based, and in an information age, computers would seem to be an obvious platform for combining various activities, and thereby their benefits. This idea brings us to how memory is something that is experienced in the present. When I spoke with Tracy Banks at Sefton Pensioners Centre in Southport, I found in her one of the many people who are keen to get across how people with dementia are people in the here and now, and not just people whose life is in a past to be recorded.
When I was at the care home, we had, you've probably seen memory boxes to look at your ears, but what we always found really good was when people first came into care, is we'd get the families to come in and sit down, spend an afternoon building a memory box, and usually pictures and artefacts and stuff. And that produced a lot of really good work with that individual at that time. And that was something that we used to put outside the door of their room and always produced good results. but anything that looks at recording, and but like you say, not just things from the past as you're looking into, but things now that we're dealing with now to help them remember from day to day. I think that's really important. As dementia progresses, like I said to you before, it's not the big things that are important, it's the little things. You know, for example, we had a lady who was very, very poorly, and she was restless, and we couldn't figure out what it was. And when I say poorly, she was very poorly. She was like very, very close to death. And one of the girls said to her, "Would you like to have a soak in the bath?" And her face lit up and she smiled. She could understand that. And she got into the bath and she was like, she was a different person. And, you know, for me, from a personal point of view, personal hygiene is really important. And if I couldn't express that when I'm older, then I could become quite agitated and quite upset. But that, you know, my life then might be very important to me, but it's only a small thing.
These small things that are important to us all, whether it's having a bath or anything else, are things that, if recorded, can make the kind of difference to our well-being that can be all the difference when we are at our most vulnerable. Tracy went on to recommend the use of a diary as part of memories to be recorded, so that upcoming events in a person's life are noted and can be accessed to reassure the person when they forget from moment to moment.
I mean, what might be like seem like a trivial issue to me might be something really important to him, you know, to me, and it could be something really, you know, of no importance whatsoever. But for him, that's something that's on his mind, and sometimes people get a point and they focus on it and on it and on it and on it, and, you know, they don't let it go. So to have that kind of way of reminding them, even like the staff can use it, you know, I've said he's agreed, and we've said to the staff, you know, if he asks questions about this, he's got this book, come in and look at it with him, and you know, he can say, oh yeah, well look, this is what we discussed on that day, this is what's happening about it.
Viewing the person with memory loss as a person with a future chimes strongly with the work of Culture Lab at Newcastle University. When I met up with Stephen Lindsay, one of the researchers, he showed me their ambient kitchen. It's a kitchen that looks like any other, only it's fitted with technologies for assisting people with dementia so that they can carry on doing one of the things that research has shown they often want to do, which is to say, the things they normally do. He told me about how some of these technologies can record someone's cooking patterns so that prompts can be made when their memory deserts them. I was struck by the subtle and various levels at which Culture Lab understands memory and what it means to be a person.
So we want to cut together a video of how they move these things around, make a short video, but actually show how they're doing the cooking process. And then from that, what we want to do is we want, you know, so one thing is we can show that to other people, and that's just a nice thing to be able to show. It's like your own little cookery show. But the other nice thing is that you can play that back to someone and they can see how they used to make something or what they did. So it actually records what they're doing and gives them that memory.
You're talking about a very subtle level of what it is that we think is important to remember.
Mm.
What you're recording is something that's really quite fundamental in someone's day, isn't it? You know, to prepare a meal. Yeah. And everyone cooks the same meal differently.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is part of the problem as well, of course, because you've got to work out how are we going to cut this together? Because we don't want to just record the 4-hour session of someone preparing a roast, putting it in the oven and leaving it. You know, we want to just pull out the pertinent bits and show them that. The other sort of related concept there is we have a cookery book program which recognises the page you turn, or we used to have a program that recognised the page you turn a cookery book to, which was in the older version of the kitchen. The current version is a slightly new rebuilt one, and the point with that one was that it would record times where you prepared meals from it, and then when you looked at the page again, it would play back the times that you prepared or ate that meal. So, you know, if there was a big thing you took your cookery book out for to do once a year, like prepare food for everyone at, Halloween or bonfire nights, you know, you'd record that, record when they were eaten, and then have that record there to play back next time you're doing it to help sort of promote reminiscing about the last few times you were there and what happened, that sort of thing. So again, just a nice reminiscence prompt if you want.
Whenever I've spoken with people about the potential for technology to assist people with dementia, it's sometimes met with scepticism. Questions arise as to who will pay for it. Then there is the assumption that older people are mostly technophobic. These kinds of problems were touched on last year in an evaluation of iPads in care homes carried out by the University of Worcester. The results were encouraging. it was found that tablet computers were easily accepted because they're small and have no keyboard or mouse. With help, people with dementia exercised their memories, communicated with distant relatives, and were happy to use a wide range of apps. One large-scale project that concurs with these encouraging findings about digital media and dementia was Culture Shock. This partnership project, led by Tyne and Weir Museums, gave the opportunity for 550 people to put together digital stories that are now part of the Museum Service collection. Alex Henry, who led the project, explains what digital storytelling is.
Digital storytelling is a way of getting those untold stories told, those hidden stories, giving people an opportunity to have a voice, to be able to tell their story. I think what makes digital storytelling unique to other kind of mediums is this idea that it's participant-led. So people have that control and that ownership over the production of their story.
Some of the Culture Shock participants had never used computers before, and some were people with dementia. Alex describes some of the experiences for them and their families.
We could see that significant things were happening. Like one of the participants, when she heard herself back on the audio recording, was almost testing herself. So she was saying the story before the recording of herself said it, as if she was testing her memory, and she was correcting herself when she was saying things wrong. Using the photographs as well has really helped with memory recall, and it's definitely brought families closer together. There were certain disclosures made, quite serious disclosures, which have now gone into their care plans, so that in the future, care workers know that if they get distressed in a certain situation, they know that there's a reason behind it. And that's one reason why life story work is so important, working with people with dementia. And this is one way of capturing those life stories, I think, in a much more engaging way than just a dry, one-page document. And it's also something for the carers to have as well. I know it might sound horrible to say, but, when the time comes and somebody passes on, for the family to have something to kind of remember them by.
This kind of work with information technology inevitably involves money. The evaluation of iPads in care homes mentioned earlier had cited high setup costs as a problem, as was the ongoing need for equipment updates and staff training. One way to get around these problems might be to establish an independent memory recording service and thereby relieve care organisations of the burdens of setting up and maintaining IT infrastructure. Such an organisation would also benefit from being a social enterprise to secure its continuity, which is vital to make memory work credible. This is not such an off-the-wall idea. Alex Henry, who you just heard, has set up Curiosity Creative, a venture that's working towards a social enterprise that supplies digital storytelling for a variety of settings. Alex's digital storytelling venture is one way that technology and a dash of entrepreneurship could have something to offer for people with dementia. There may be many other ways too. I suggested this to Lynn Corner. Lynn is the Director of Engagement at Changing Age, Newcastle University's commitment to finding solutions to the challenges presented by an ageing population. She spoke about how a variety of technological solutions reflects the variety in those who use them.
And what people with dementia need is choice. And that's a range of products available to them, a range of ways of communicating, a range of ways of getting their perspectives over. That's what we need, because people with dementia are not a case of one size fits all. Of course they're not. By the very fact that people are older, we would argue here that means that they're different. They're more different because they've had longer to get different. Mm-hmm. And just because you develop dementia doesn't mean to say you're going to be the same as the next person with dementia. Of course not. If you think about it, all people with dementia are individuals, and their family needs, their family circumstances are different. And so anything that uses technology to be able to help people to articulate what they're interested in, what their needs are as a person is fantastic. And I think ways of using advocacy to help people to navigate their way around what is a very complex system, and anything that helps them make sense of that is very, very much needed. And I think, you know, this whole I think what interests me particularly through technology is how we can use that to help people to communicate. Because one of the big challenges for dementia is that people are isolated. They're isolated by the nature of their dementia in that, you know, it does challenge verbal communication, so people find that very difficult. And one of the areas that we're particularly interested in working in and doing more work in really is how we raise awareness amongst the public and amongst members of staff really in certain organisations about what the experience of dementia is like. And again, work on life story and ways of sort of connecting people so that we can understand their experience and, you know, think about what will help them live well with dementia is really, really important.
Helping people with dementia both to communicate their wishes and navigate their way are skills and experiences that advocacy groups might consider bringing to services that could generate income for the work they do. Lynn agreed that defining what you have to offer and what's unique about it may be difficult, but it's an essential component when designing any kind of enterprise. Not every university has a changing age for business team, like the one at Newcastle, but it's worthwhile for advocacy groups to look at what their local universities are doing to enable partnerships between research, businesses, the third sector, and other interest groups. I also spoke with Rebecca Jenkins, a writer who recently finished work on a new Writing North project that explored the uses of creative writing and recording in collaboration with people with dementia. Given her experiences with this kind of collaboration, I asked her how she thought a memory recording service might work.
I think my model would be that you could actually produce as simple as possible software and recording package, along with a booklet that you could publicize as almost a commercial package that says to everybody, as you're growing old, it can be useful to you to be able to record things along these lines, particularly if you've been diagnosed with something. And this is part of almost the therapy of reacting to the diagnosis, is to say, you could use these are the techniques, this is what has worked for other people, this could be very valuable and useful to you. And the outcome is this particular CD memory stick, memory file or whatever that is portable and can work on all these ordinary average computers, etc., that are in every home. And that would be a most useful package that could then go widely for other people. It could also be adaptable, so it's not just for Alzheimer's and dementia. It could be for, you know, granny who wants to tell her stories to her the next generation down or whatever it is. And so, there are huge amounts of people who love doing their family tree and stuff. People aren't seen to be batty or scary if they do that. So if you could produce a product where you'd thought about some of the problems and you'd made it as interactive and as absorbed into the normal technology in the average home as possible, then you've actually got something to work with that advocates and everyone else could use.
Her idea offers the possibility of easing the distress of a diagnosis by placing a practical tool in someone's hands so that there is something else that they can do about their situation. This could help encourage more people to take action earlier on. Recording minute details that enable people to tell the ongoing stories of their lives is something that is increasingly happening as the tools to do this on the internet get more and more popular. In fact, there is already a tool that offers the kind of features that Rebecca speculated on. That tool is Evernote. Evernote is a web-based tool that allows users to store and organize all kinds of data, text documents, sound recordings, videos, and so on. These data can be created on and synchronized between desktop computers, tablets, iPads, smartphones, and from anywhere in the world. There's a growing catalogue of apps that can be added to Evernote for anyone interested in specialized activities. There's even something called Evernote Food for creating a food journal of what you've cooked, what you've eaten, who with, where, and when. Perhaps this could be integrated into the ambient kitchen we heard about. Evernote is offered free, it's cheap to upgrade, and educational institutions are increasingly using it. The appeal may be down to the simple and non-technical interface that lets you get stuck in straight away. Families can start using tools like Evernote without any authority's permission, and in many cases, without any support. They're adults, and it's a decision for them. What advocacy groups can do is make them aware that the tools exist. After all, these tools offer a great degree of something that the advocacy movement values highly, and that's empowerment. Beyond this, we've seen how advocates can ensure that there is a continuity to the use of memory recording. Perhaps providing this continuity is something that advocacy groups can think about as being their support for families who want to do memory work. Perhaps services can be developed so that memories recorded in Evernote are referred to and added to in family discussions with advocates. It might even be possible for software developers to produce specialist dementia apps for advocacy groups. How about, for example, a tool for checking that recordings that care services are given access to are still being used by them? This would be the keeping the document live, as Mike Pochin put it earlier. I recommend these advocacy interventions because we've seen how important it is to ensure that there are people there to engage with people with dementia, not just another system or procedure. We've seen this in the examples of the Steve McQueen fan and the former decorator. In other words, any technology, just like any memory work generally, needs to be backed up by an engagement with people with dementia, their families, and carers. Any memory recording service would, of course, entail legal and ethical matters. These and other details will be discussed in my Quick Start Guide to Memory Recording, which will be published by Opal in July 2012. Opal is spelt O-P-A-A-L, and the website address is www.opal.org.uk. Some of the organisations in this podcast are Opal members, so for more information about membership, visit the website. Get in touch also if you're interested in contributing anything to the Quick Start Guide. This might include your own experiences of memory work, or experiences of useful software like Evernote. Or perhaps you'd like to register your interest in setting up a memory recording service in partnership with Opal and its members. Whatever you do, please bear in mind that the Quick Start Guide will be completed by mid-July 2012. Finally, before we all get too carried away with what technology can do, I'd like to hand over the final word to Rebecca Jenkins, for whom it is the people using technology that we should be more excited about.
We have a society that wants to find the magic bullet solutions because they don't want to live with things. And one of the things you cannot do about aging is refuse to live with it, because what you're doing is you're refusing to live with yourself or your future self. And I think if one could achieve a society where people who are old were able to keep enough of their personhood and enough of their communication skills enhanced by other things to be models to the people who are coming after them, to say that actually old age is something you can manage decently, and our society does actually respect and value old age just as it looks after your children, then that is a much more prosperous and happier society. And I think that's what one should be aspiring to get to.